everybody, my name's Colin Ellis, author of Culture Fix, Culture Hacks, and the Hybrid Handbook. On the Culture Makers podcast, I ask leaders from around the world to share a little bit of their story and what works well for them in the world of workplace culture. I hope you enjoy today's show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Culture Makers podcast. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Richard Corney. Richard is the managing director at Inigo Coffee Group and has been in the coffee industry for 16 years, beginning with his first cafe in 2006, which feels like a lifetime ago. His career has taken him from behind the coffee machine to coffee farms in Colombia, washing stations in Burundi, to head judging the World Barista Championships. His work with growers as part of Raw Material has been some of the most rewarding, developing and building new relationships with in-country partners for project work in Rwanda and Burundi, and connecting coffee buyers with meaningful and impact-driven coffee value chains all over the world. And he joins me now from Wellington. Hello, Richard.
Hey, Colin, how you doing? Thanks a bunch for that intro.
That's all right. 2006, man, that feels like a long time ago, mate, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Now that you say it like that, it is a long time ago. I was only, 3 years out of high school. So, yes, it was.
And so where was home then originally, Richard? Was whereabouts in New Zealand was home?
I grew up in Hawke's Bay in Napier. Went to Napier Boys High School. That's where I had my first cafe in Napier. Did a two-year stint in the Navy, but then left that. Went to culinary school in Hawke's Bay, and then in the November of that year, started my own cafe with a business partner, and then essentially sort of within two years from that, I was curious enough to want to roast my own coffee, and I suppose that's where the Flight Coffee journey really started, or the Inigo Coffee Group's journey started.
So let's just jump back very, very quickly, because you very quickly glossed over the fact that you were in the Navy for 2 years. Was that was kind of that a burning ambition in high school? Were you just like, I really want to be in the Navy? Was it a family thing? What started that?
That's a great question. All throughout my high school years, I wanted to join the military of some description, either the Air Force or the Navy. Good family friend of ours, their son joined as an officer, and I had a part-time job working in an Italian restaurant in my fifth, sixth and seventh form year at Napier, working weekends. Didn't want to join the Navy as a chef, joined as communications branch, and then sort of sated my appetite, as it were, and then sort of like, oh yeah, this is fun, but you know, going nowhere fast. I mean, you can go places, absolutely, but certainly not where I wanted to sort of see myself. Really glad I didn't join as a chef, despite the fact that I was working in hospitality. And then sort of when I went to culinary school at the start of 2006, that was really great, actually, because it sort of picked up on the passion that I had for food, and that really sort of became the foundation of the first cafe that I had.
And so then working in hospitality was, you know, did you have, and obviously working in, you know, you went to culinary school, so there was obviously a kind of a real, I suppose, interest in the mechanics of things like coffee and food, and then obviously there's the serving element as well. Did the coffee side of it then just evolve over time, over those few years, Richard? How did that all work out?
Quite by accident, actually. When I went to culinary school, I didn't even drink coffee. Like I when I started the cafe, like I wanted to do the stuff in the kitchen, do the, you know, be out the back and do all that. But as you experience in hospitality, like when you're an own operator, you go where you're needed, and I was needed on the floor, so at the front, and eventually found myself on the coffee machine. And you know, it's a food, really, food product type coffee, and like anything in food, it's got variables, and those, to control those variables, you know, has an impact on the output and the quality, as does the input. So essentially, yeah, I got curious, and sort of that's where I kind of fell in love with coffee.
And so then part of that kind of cafe, I suppose, culture. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about coffee because it's own culture and cafes, particularly in New Zealand, Australia. Did it, you know, kind of in those early days, did you feel part of something? Did you feel part of a team? Was there lots of camaraderie? Is that kind of, you know, when you think, you know, kind of fast forward, whatever it is now, 16 years and you're a business owner, when you look back at the kind of culture that you create within your own cafes, do you very much look back and think, oh, well, that's where I got my ground and that's where I learned how to build a team, be part of a team?
Yeah, it went back even further than that. The restaurant that I worked in during high school was Trattoria alla Toscana. It's an Italian family restaurant run by a couple, Kim and Reza Saber. And they didn't really have any kids of their own. They always said, you know, the restaurant staff were their children. And, you know, like this was my first job. It was my first introduction into hospitality. And just by virtue of the fact that this is just how it was for Reza when he was growing up in Italy in the late 60s and 70s, you know, whenever I was working a shift, I would work a sort of 8, 9 hour shift. And it would, you know, you wouldn't really stop. Now, notwithstanding labor laws, that didn't bother me at all. Like that was just like you talk about camaraderie, you talk about sort of the culture. It was like we worked really hard, but then at the end of each, you know, at the end of big weekends or big shifts, it might be 11 o'clock, 12 in the morning where we finish up cleaning the restaurant and there's a leg of lamb has gone in the oven or a big dish of pasta and we all sit down in the restaurant and those old enough are having a glass of Chianti and there's a 16-year-old, a dirty can of Coke. And that was really the foundation of what I guess what built my work ethic. It was mm-hmm. There was no other expectation than just getting in, getting the job done and getting finished. And then at the end you sort of relax. Certainly had its moments. It's sort of not easy, but like I look back at that and I think that that was one of the most important foundations and important lessons, not just for my life, but business and everything else. And so, you know, fast forward to my own cafe, sort of similar, you know, similar vibes. Like, right, when you're in the thick of it in hospitality, right, you've got a team, you've got a hustle. It might be 12 o'clock, it might be someone's lunch break. But, you know, you're not going to be that person that buggers off to lunch when you're in the middle of a lunch rush. So, you know, it's that you get in, you get dirty. It's a bit of an adrenaline rush too. And you get the job done. And, you know, at the end or beforehand is when you sort of take the time to relax and celebrate.
It's fascinating to say that, you know, one of the things that I talk a lot about is the fact that our parents can only prepare us so much for work, but then often our experiences in those early days shape the kind of person that we want to be, both positively and negatively. Obviously, from your perspective, it was positive. It's like, you know, I feel part of something bigger than myself, blah, blah, blah. Whereas, you know, just as easily be negative. And then, so you're in Hawke's Bay, you're working in a cafe. What did you then purchase your own business, start your own business? Was that how it worked, and then that led you to roasting?
Yes, we set the cafe up as its own sort of business, and then through, I think it was 2008, a good friend of mine who was at the time here living in Wellington. In fact, we've been friends since we were seven. I told him I had this grand idea. I wanted to roast my own coffee. And he's like, great, well, I'm going to do it with you so you don't get up. So he and I scrounged around for investment. I'm trying to get some money from the bank and they weren't interested.
How old were you, Richard? Sorry to interrupt. How old were you?
I was 24, I think, at the time.
So early 20s. And this is still in Hawke's Bay, where probably the concept of a 24-year-old roasting his own beans, the bank's not like, oh.
Oh, yeah. They probably quite rightfully took one look at me and thought, liability alert. but look, we got really lucky, actually. My parents' next-door neighbor at the time ended up being an angel investor in the business. She for many years had taught the concept of angel investment, I think somewhere in Norway for many years, and then sort of realized, I'll practice what I preach. And anyway, so she was the initial investor, just cash investor. And, you know, she got her 8%. She was stoked. She thought 8% was really generous. I thought that was also really generous. that's what really kicked things off. And so sort of Matt and I got roasting. I mean, I was flying myself and that was about it for the better part of the first sort of 18 months. And then within that time, he introduced me to a mutual friend of his through the industry, Nick, who you would know.
Yeah.
And then when Nick came on board, the sort of three things that we kept really were the name, Flight Coffee, the roaster, and then the PNG single origin coffee beans that we were roasting at the time. And that's sort of where Nick jumped in. And within, I think, sort of 6 months from that, we had opened Memphis Belle. Early 2010.
This is in Wellington. So you'd made the kind of move. Was that a deliberate move? You were like, okay, so we love our Hawke's Bay operation, but really we need to be kind of where the people are. Not that there aren't many people in Hawke's Bay, but obviously there are more people in Wellington.
Yeah, look, I mean, Wellington was always on the cards as being, at the time it was the coffee mecca for New Zealand. Well, far as we were concerned anyway. You had sort of like Mojo at the time that was really starting to blossom in terms of its multi-retail store or franchise concept. You've had sort of Coffee Supreme at the time sort of pivoting into the sort of specialty coffee realm. And we really wanted our own spot down here. And I was constrained and sort of bound to Hawke's Bay. We had sort of Emma, our daughter, in 2010. And so we couldn't afford to live down here at the time. So I was roasting up there and sending coffee down here. And that's sort of with Memphis kicking off, and Nick was sort of running the show, and that was the start, really, early 2010.
And I remember those days, Richard, because we'd emigrated to New Zealand in late 2007. We just had a little girl, and I remember my wife was out in Wellington with the kids, didn't have anything to do, and she happened across Memphis in 2010. I remember coming home, and she was just like, I found this awesome coffee spot. And so that was for you, Matt, and Nick. You used to call yourselves the Flight Coffee Triceratops or something like that, I think. back in the day. So for you guys, that was a huge moment. And did you bring on staff? Like, you know, how did that feel then, making that transition to really running something and thinking, I guess, longer term about, well, how do we sustain this as a business now?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And I think, like, it's important to remember Nick he's like 4 years younger than us. So like Matt and I, so he was either 19, 20 at the time. And, you know, it was one of those things where it was like running on the smell of an oily rag. We started Memphis in 2020, April 2010, I think. And, you know, Nick needed just enough money for beer and rent. That's all he cared about. I was roasting and, you know, I was sort of getting paid a pittance, as you do. But, like, we really had no – this is the crazy thing. We really had no real plan other than we knew we wanted to do more in Wellington. And so sort of that sort of trend, like, throughout 2010, 2011, we were sort of planning. We had a little espresso bar up in Napier at the time, and we were planning the, you know, the transition and the move to Wellington. And that's when we actually had set up the hangar, or we'd signed the lease for the hangar. And in actual fact, it's 10 years old this week, the 10th of September.
I still remember the opening. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you were there, right.
You were there, yeah.
10 years old on the 10th of September. And we signed that lease, I think, back in February 2011. And we didn't, 2012, sorry, and we didn't get open until the September of that year. But in the meantime, sort of June, July, we moved the roastery and the roaster down, and we put the roaster into the hangar. And then it was sort of at that point where we really wanted to create something super special, really sort of doubled down on the specialty coffee element of, the industry and do really cool things and do it really, really well. In terms of plans, I mean, they were loose at best to do something really well. Grow a wholesale business. In May 2011, we sort of got together and we were like, what's a goal that we want? And this was really our only guiding light or North Star at the time. And we wanted to be recognized internationally as the foremost and best coffee roaster in New Zealand. And so we figured, look, if that's our guiding light, if that's our North Star, then whatever we do and doing it around that below it, then, you know, if that can contribute to that goal, then that's got to be something positive.
Yeah, so if people listen, they haven't been, if you're in Wellington or if you're visiting Wellington, the Flight Coffee Hangar is on Dixon Street, and it's an awesome little space. And like many of the coffee shops and coffee houses that you go to, I mean, the coffee's fabulous, of course it is, but they have their own almost micro culture. And this is what I love about coffee. You know, I talk about it on my other podcast, Culture and Coffee, is they have their own little culture with people who really enjoy coffee, and it's like wine or or whiskey. And so building a team that's really dedicated to that, Richard, and finding people who want, who've got this relentless passion for coffee, is that something you struggle with? Is it easy to do? Do you find that, particularly in Wellington, which is quite a coffee, you know, coffee little capital, do you find that, that there are lots of people who want to work in that environment?
Notwithstanding the current situation with COVID, we've had closed borders for the better part of 2.5 years, and they're only just starting to open. So just putting that to the side, we do biannual engagement surveys, and one of our top performing results is that our staff are proud to work for Flight Coffee. And we have people who, you know, they want to work for us because of who we are as a company and what we sort of stand for, and sort of our procurement and our buying ethos, in particular the, you know, the purchasing through raw material. So in terms of finding people who want to work for us based in that sort of within that subculture, like traditionally it hasn't been difficult at all, notwithstanding the current environment. But putting that to the side, you know, that's something that we really want to, you know, that we're really proud of, to be honest, and something that we really want to keep and maintain. And I guess, you know, on the point of sort of subculture and coffee culture, I mean, we've gone full circle. When we first started, it was almost exclusive. It was almost super specialty, right? Hyper niche. We wanted to do these very unique things, roast these very sort of different and out there coffees and brew them in ways that, you know, weren't traditionally done. And while that's still really important to us, actually what we want to do now is we want to make coffee way more accessible to the masses. You know, so much has changed in the last sort of 10 years with coffee consumption, the advent of, you know, the Nespresso pod, the advent of canned coffee beverages. You know, you've got these massive other parts of the market that consumers who are not our normal consumer are consuming. So, you know, how do we go about by bringing them into our fold and at the same time having our team, you know, be a part of that? So, yeah, there's a really great sort of culture within the company that engagement result was awesome for us. And that was the second one, actually, of that score within the last two. So
that's testament to the work that you do, Richard. You know, one of the things that I read on the website is almost your values is stay hungry, stay curious, and have fun. And you really get a sense of that when you visit, you know, particularly I was in the Flight Coffee Hangar not so long ago. You really get that sense. There is that sense of fun and curiosity. But I wanted to ask you before we finish, I wanted to ask you about raw material, because raw material is you guys working overseas with growers. You explain it better than me. So you go ahead. Tell me a little bit about raw material.
Sure thing. So Matt Grayley, one of the original founders, in 2011, his wife, Kai, she went to study at Harvard for 2 years. And as a part of that, he got a green card. And Matt's goal has always been to use the demand that Flight Coffee generates in terms of, you know, green coffee demand to the best and most effective means possible. So the sort of 2011 was the year that sort of enabled the inception of what raw material is now, and that's been led by and large by Matt. He's got an amazing team with him, Miguel, who is one of the other sort of co-founders of raw material. He's based out of Colombia, Alan in the UK. And essentially, raw material is a social enterprise where 100% of the profits go back to coffee producers, either in way of stable and predictable prices or investment in community-based assets. So part of raw material's goal is to identify areas or origins in the world that have the highest need. Examples of this are Timor-Leste and Burundi, two of the most in need of investment coffee-producing countries on the planet. And the work carried out in Timor-Leste is super important. It's lifting the quality of coffee that's produced there and the subsequent income that coffee producers there can earn. So currently, raw material operates in several countries: Colombia, Mexico, Timor-Leste, Burundi, and there's a partnership in Rwanda. Up until very recently, supply strain constraints, over 70% of the coffee that Flight Coffee purchased was through raw material. So that's something we're incredibly proud of, and if you talk to any of our staff, it's that sort of connection with origin through raw material of which makes them so proud to work for Flight.
And you know, I love reading the story of raw material, how you create those connections with growers, and then, and I, you know, what a lot of people kind of perhaps don't see, or maybe they do see it, is when you present that information to coffee drinkers. So you do feel that connection. Mm-hmm. This is why I have a strong desire to always find out, where's the coffee come from? Where is it grown? Who's grown? I love all of that information, which you just present usually just on a tiny little card when you get your coffee.
Yeah.
Which provides that connection, right, Richard?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, that's as close as a general consumer, for the most part, will ever get to the source, right? So if you can provide some sort of conduit to that and make that a part of the experience, then, that's only a good thing in terms of customer experience as well.
Yeah. I got two more questions to ask you. The first is about the price of a cup of coffee. Now, I know this is something that you're really passionate about. I remember reading a very long post about this, but it is strange to me. And I was talking to someone else recently about the cost of a glass of wine and the cost of a cup of coffee, because like here in Melbourne, like a sandwich is like $15 now. And yet the price of coffee stayed the same. And yet surely it has the same supply chain issues as everything else. Do you think that we value the amount of work, time, effort that goes into producing coffee? Richard, do you think now's the time for coffee prices to go up?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the general consumer base, the majority of the bell curve, don't appreciate the value of a cup of coffee. And without getting overly emotional about that statement, the fact of the matter remains, when I first started my cafe in 2006, a flat white was $3.50. Well, there are places around New Zealand selling coffee, a flat white, medium flat white, for $4, or $3.80 or $4.20. And in real terms, that hasn't moved with CPI or inflation. It hasn't moved with the minimum wage increase, which I think is about 65% in the last 15 years, which, by the way, is a fantastic thing. It absolutely needs to happen, that the minimum wage increases. But when you take into consideration those accounts, along with other operating cost factors, like the rent at the hangars has doubled since we've been there in the last 10 years. Our landlord's not greedy. That's the market rate. That's the value of that per square meter over that time. And so when you have those, when you have all those considerations and all those factors on a piece of paper, the numbers do not make sense. Mm. In real terms, a cup of coffee should be upwards of $7, for your medium flat white. Now, are people going to pay that? Probably not. Most people probably not. There's got to be a bit of a reconciliation, a bit of movement, from sort of both sides. But yeah, a cup of coffee is I would say genuinely well undervalued by the general consumer, and it's very easy to look at it at the sum of its parts, right, and go, that's just ridiculous. Well, okay, let's just lift the veil and look behind the curtain, and you'll see very quickly what goes in behind it and how those costs and the current price doesn't make sense.
Yeah, completely agree. And I'm always happy to pay a little bit more for a good cup of coffee, Richard. I think people see it as hot water through coffee grounds into a cup and think, oh, well, this is worth four. Anyway, hopefully for the people listening, they do value their cup of coffee and maybe prepared to pay the dollar or two more. I got one more question for you, mate. So when you think back to younger Richard Corney starting his first coffee shop and starting his first business, how do you educate yourself, Richard, in terms of what you're learning? How are you making sure that you're growing a safe workplace that people feel connected to? You read, you listen to podcasts. What's your way of staying relevant?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Given the 10th birthday of the hangar today, this week I've had a bit of time to reflect on the last few years, or the last 10 years in particular, and or even 15. And I put up a little Facebook post in recognition of the hangar and all the staff that have worked with us over that 10 years. And I said, in that I said, I would have given now my current self, my younger self, advice that I probably wouldn't have listened to, which is frightening, because now when I know the relative risk and the need to generate return on investment and business plan and so forth. I mean, man, we were flying by the seat of our pants. At the same time, I was working 90-hour weeks on weeks on end, completely unsustainable. But there was no other option, and we wouldn't have had it any other way. We were having a lot of fun. Yeah. How I sort of try and keep things relevant now is actually take time out, pause, reflect, talk to other business owners. I'm actually really I'm quite open to talking about business and what goes into to making a hospitality establishment work. I mean, I've spoken a lot to our wholesale clients, to some of them, just about the challenges we've faced this year. you know, for example, and you know, what a reasonable operating margin for their cafe is, you know, and no, it shouldn't be 3% because, you know, are you paying yourself? I'm trying to talk more, I guess, with more people and just share some of my own experiences is one of the things. I don't meditate enough, but when I'm in flow, I'll have a good session of mindfulness meditation. That's always good. I certainly have better sleeps afterwards. But yeah, just trying to take more time out for myself with the family and share with those whoever just want to ask questions, really.
Awesome. Well, that's fabulous advice. I think we can all spend a bit more time with the people that we love and actually make time for peace and quiet. That definitely. In fact, I might go and do that myself now. Hey, Richard, I want to say a huge thank you. I know you're a busy, very busy individual. Thank you so much for taking your time out today to talk to us here on the Culture Makers Podcast.
Oh, absolute pleasure, Colin. It's really great talking to you.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with colleagues and friends or your connections on social media. Better still, why not keep the conversation going and join our community of culture makers for free? Share information from around the world on how to create a great place to work. You can join us at www.culturemakers.community.